You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network. Visit bpn.fm to discover more. Attention all theater lovers! This Sunday, April 21st, Broadway Podcast Network is holding the first ever Broadway Podfest, a full day of podcast recordings with some of your favorite Broadway stars, live from the Museum of Broadway, which is right in the heart of Times Square. The day begins at 11 a.m. Eastern and features a full day of programming that you don't want to miss. Visit bpn.fm/podfest to get all the details and register to attend for free. That's bpn.fm/podfest.
America, we are endowed by our Creator with certain unalienable rights, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. At Grand Canyon University, we believe in equal opportunity, and the American dream starts with purpose. By honoring your career calling, you impact your family, your friends, and your community. The pursuit to serve others is yours. Find your purpose at Grand Canyon University. Private, Christian, affordable. Visit gcu.edu.
I'm Jamie Dumont.
I'm Rob Russo.
And this is The Fabulous Invalid. Tonight, you may notice that we are coming to you from Orso again, the lovely Orso restaurant in Times Square.
Off Times Square.
Please off Times Square.
Off,
I can't,
on Restaurant Row.
I can't get these offs and ins and ons.
Your ins
correct.
And offs and ons.
No, yeah. I'm always saying, I'll be the guy saying in Broadway today. So I'm a fool. What can I say?
Well, tonight we have joining us, I want to say legendary set designer.
We say legendary about everybody.
Well, but he is. He's a big deal. David Rockwell, whose work you will assuredly know if you've seen a Broadway show in the last 15 years at least.
He's a very big deal.
He's a very big deal. Like,
it was hard to research him because he has done
so much,
everything.
Right.
It's impossible to fathom all of the work that he's done in his...
Well, and you know, the one thing I've learned from doing a lot of biographies to prep my boss in my other job is the longer someone's bio is, usually the less they've accomplished, right? You know, so when you read someone like David Rockwell's bio, it's so crisp because what it contains is so much, if that makes sense, right? A sentence like, oh, you know, he's got a firm of 250 people. Like, oh my gosh, think of the incredible amount of design work that they're doing, you know, with a 250-person firm.
All over the world.
All over the world, yeah.
Yeah, he's unlike no other person that works on Broadway.
Oh, that's true.
See, I got it right.
On Broadway. Very good, very good. Cool. Well, I've just come from London. Short trip to London.
Ooh, la la.
Where we learned that things play in the West End, not on the West End.
Thank
right?
you, Tracy Bennett.
Thank you, Tracy Bennett. No, so I've just come back and had a nice, quick little trip. I try to get to London at least once a year, if not more, because there is so much cross-pollination now.
Aren't you going in a few weeks?
I am going again next month. You call me out here. Because I couldn't resist. Well,
only because I have access to your calendar, which you were foolish to give me.
Right, right. Well, you know, there's so much cross-pollination, you know, these days that it's really exciting to see things over there that come here and vice versa.
Okay, what did you see?
So this trip ended up being a little musical trip. I saw three musicals. Hadestown, which is a new musical that was at New York Theatre Workshop in 2016 and is now at the National Theatre in London in a pre-Broadway stint.
Once upon a time there was a railroad line. Don't ask where, brother, don't ask where. It was a road to hell. Oh, it was hard times. It was a world of gods and men. It's an old song.
It's an old song.
It's an old tale from way back when. It's an old song.
It's an old song.
And we're gonna sing it again. Now on the road to hell, there was a railroad. Ford line. And there were three old women all dressed the same. And they was always singing in the back of your mind. Everybody meet the face.
And then I saw Dreamgirls, which is a big splashy revival of the famous...
Which I have not seen this production six times.
Right, that's why Jamie has not seen it. He could not tell me exactly where to sit at the Savoy Theater.
I did tell you where to sit.
Down to the seat number.
What about what I need?
Curtis says it's the best thing for the group.
What about what's best for me?
He feels the dreams can cross over.
What about how I feel?
But when we're famous, I'll write great things for you. Effie, do it for me.
What about me? What about me?
And then the last show I saw was Company.
Ooh.
Which, oh my gosh. For those who are listening, if you have an opportunity to see it in London, please do. Do what you can to get a ticket. I absolutely was blown away by this production. So if you don't know, the novelty, and I hate using that word because it makes it sound like a gimmick, but the novelty of this production is that Bobby, the lead character, is B-O-B-B-I-E, Bobby, a woman, this time, with Sondheim's blessing and a few lyric and character changes. We now have a female lead of the show that is about, usually about a bachelor, you know, negotiating bachelorhood among all of his married friends. And I have to say, it is, I also hate to use this word because it feels overblown, but revelatory. It totally just cracks open this musical and it hits in such a different way. It was really quite amazing.
I'm very curious.
Yeah, yeah. And I will say, I mean, one thing that someone tweeted this, and I could not agree more. I wish I had written down who tweeted it. You know, Company is a perfect musical, as is, right? It does not need to be fixed. And so this isn't an attempt to fix. It's not Merrily We Roll Along. No offense to the Merrily We Roll Along fans out there. But
Russo.
That is a show that, you know, has just sort of never worked, right? You might love the score, you might
it's
love
true.
The story,
it,
but it's
true.
Just never worked. And I'm eager to see the production that's coming around about this winter at their off-Broadway space, the Laura Pels. But Company is a perfect musical, so this is not an attempt to fix it in any way. It's a way to see it through a new lens. And it's really thrilling, especially for a show that you know so well and that does have such good bones. You know, to hear Being Alive sung by a woman in the context of the show. You know, Bernadette Peters does it in Carnegie Hall, right? And it's amazing and powerful and beautiful. But in the context of the show, to arrive at that moment,
it's sort of timeless, this production, right? It's not specifically set in the 70s. It's not specifically set now. However, there are cell phones, correct?
Right, right. So I will say, you know, despite the fact that I just called it a perfect musical, it is a perfect musical. But one challenge of doing Company as the years go by is that it really is a period piece. It's hard to perform that show without respecting the fact that it was written in 1970 because of references.
What's wrong with 1970, Rob?
Nothing wrong with 1970. But if you do want to set it in the present, there's no way to really do it without making some changes. And Sondheim has actually himself made those changes. So we know they're approved and given us a version that I think will be able to live on, whether or not it's a female or male Bobby. The lyric changes that update the cultural references and the temporal references, I think, will come in handy for the future.
I'm curious because I can't imagine a company that's not set in the 70s. But I'm a geezer that way, right?
Right.
Like it's hard for me to make my brain do new tricks.
One of my cardinal rules is will travel for Sondheim, right? So I go everywhere to see any Sondheim production that I possibly can, especially Company. Company's, you know, one of my all-time favorites, if not my favorite Sondheim musical. And so I've seen six or seven different productions. I have seen productions that try to set it in the present. And it doesn't really work unless you really commit to it. And the only way to really commit to it would be to have to change some of the references. So this is an exciting production. I really hope there was some gossip in the New York Post about it potentially coming to Broadway. I really hope that happens. If only because this production deserves a longer life and a bigger audience.
Well, let's hope it comes in. But speaking of coming in, I see that Mr. Rockwell is walking through the door, so I think we should wrap it up.
Perfect. Joining us at our usual table this week is Broadway set designer David Rockwell. You'll know David's work from such shows as Hairspray, Kinky Boots, and She Loves Me, for which he won the 2016 Tony Award. This season alone, he'll be represented on Broadway by Pretty Woman, The Nap, Kiss Me Kate, and Tootsie. What you might not know, though, is that David is also the founder and president of the Rockwell Group, a 250-person, award-winning, cross-disciplinary architecture and design practice that he founded in 1984. The firm's work ranges from restaurants, hotels, airport terminals, and hospitals to festivals, museum exhibitions, and, of course, Broadway set designs. David, we're so delighted to have you with us at Orso tonight.
Great. Welcome.
Thank you.
Before we get into the theater, which is what we would very much like to talk to you about, I have to circle back to the beginning of your career because I find it wonderful and astonishing that you started the Rockwell Group in 1984 when you were in your late 20s. And now you have offices in Shanghai, Madrid, and New York. I think those are the three, correct?
Yep.
And what were those early years like? What were your, who were your first clients? What was going on in 1984?
Well, you know, now looking back on it, things always seem neater and more symmetrical and more linear. But the truth was, for a bunch of reasons, my earliest love was theater. And then it morphed into an interest in architecture, having to do with where we moved. And I was lucky enough to find an education that included my love of theater and my love of architecture. And I always knew I was going to end up in New York. There was something about coming to New York, and certainly that had a lot to do with the theater. And so my earliest work as an architect was literally any job I could get. First of all, I worked for a number of firms when I got out of architecture school, and actually every year when I was studying, I'd come to New York and work for a different architect. And I found a way to take that love of performance and a love of how design creates memories and morphed that into architecture, and was lucky enough to get a lot of people interested in hiring us. So it was a sort of messy. It felt like every project was life and death. And I sort of stumbled forward with a huge amount of interest in how design can connect people. You know, as you walk around New York, I'm still amazed how at the ground level New York is still messy and vital. I think that's what attracted me to the city. Oh, the first project on my own was a 6-week design and construction renovation of Le Perigord, where we moved in a number of contractors, including people who were building sets for La Mama. It was like an Amish barn raising for Le Perigord, and I didn't know you weren't supposed to do that, so that was my first project on my own.
Wow, that sounds a little bit like they tell stories about the design of Studio 54 and how they didn't realize they weren't supposed to be doing absolutely everything that they did while they were making that building. So what was the actual first show that you worked on? Was it Off-Broadway or was it Rocky Horror?
The first show I almost did. So as I became more successful as an architect, and as I started to understand that theater was what I was researching to talk about in the built world and the architecture world, I was taking ideas from the theater, and I actually gave a talk at the TED conference, I guess in 94 or 95, when I was advised, don't speak about your profession, speak about something you're an amateur that you love. So I put together this probably overproduced talk on the relationship of theater and architecture, and I extracted 4 or 5 ideas like transformation, right? We take for granted that in theater, things are transforming in front of us. In architecture, you walk through it. And I had been sort of working peripherally in and around theater, and I started to meet with directors and started to sketch. And the first show I almost did was Seussical.
Oh, sure.
And the gods aligned that wasn't my first show. Although we built a model for it, which many directors saw. And then Daryl Roth and Jordan Roth called and said, how would you like to do the Rocky Horror Show with Chris Ashley? I had never seen the movie because as a teen, I was living in Mexico. So, you know, my popular culture was more like cantinflas and bullfights. And I rented the movie. And I said, you know, I love the idea that you guys are reaching out to me, but I got to tell you, I thought my first show was going to be like the Cherry Orchard at BAM. I was thinking it was going to be, you know, sort of an opposite pull to my more populous day job.
Well, and it's also Circle in the Square is sort of a daunting first theater to work in.
Was actually originally be at the Henry Miller.
Oh.
And so Chris and I walked through it. I fell in love with Chris. And when I asked Chris what about the show compelled him, we talked about how it's about self-creation. You know, it's about audience participation. And I realized this is the perfect first show. I walked into Circle in the Square and met Paul Libin and had an idea about the floor rotating, which he was both up for, and Raul Esparza was happy to stand in the middle of while it rotated. So it became like an amazing first experience.
I still have my red boa from the goodie bag that you could purchase or get, I guess.
That's right.
Do you remember that. The red velvet walls with the bodies coming out of it?
Sure.
Yeah, that was a tough sell. One of the things I determine that makes a great design project is when you don't know the answer before you begin. And I think that comes from opening yourself up to new experiences.
If you don't know the answer before you begin, how do you know you found the right answer? How do you know when the answer hits?
Well, there's no right answer. That's part of the thing. And you know, I think you have to start out with your research long before you get to the project. If I have to say the one quality of every designer who works at Rockwell Group and what I try and bring to theater projects is a sense of curiosity. You know, what digging deeper and deeper and deeper, which I think relates to those early experiences in Mexico of chatting and taking your time. And I remember when right after Le Perigord, I was offered a Japanese restaurant called Sushi Zen.
Oh, sure.
Which was really the breakthrough project for me. And I always tell young designers when I'm starting to work with them, don't put every idea you've ever had into your first project. Well, I didn't listen to that advice. So I got Donna Granata, who was a costume designer at the Santa Fe Opera Festival, to work with me on this 100-foot-long silk mural. And it became a kind of obsession to get that project right.
It's all very theatrical.
It is very theatrical.
Well, speaking of theater.
And
go ahead.
Let me just say, when architects use the word theatrical, I think most of them aren't referring to the most interesting part of theatrical, which isn't looking theatrical. But it is honoring an audience. And, you know, that's the thing that I think is so incredible about this difference in these theaters is, you know, they constantly creating new work for this audience. in architecture, many architects prefer to photograph their buildings without people. I think people make the building more interesting. And so my driver is really designing from the inside out, in designing from what it's going to be like to walk through, what the choreography of a space is. So there really are very direct connections to how an audience and a performance work together in theater and in architecture.
That's interesting that you say choreography, because I feel like even down to the service in the restaurant, once it's built, the waiters, all of that's choreographed, and that, all of that is a bit of theater. So it really is, it is all theatrical from the minute you walk into the door until you're given your check at the end of a meal.
And a lot of what makes good design is invisible. In theater, you know, in many cases, the set doesn't want to be the thing you're focusing on. If it's a comedy, you know, you don't necessarily want the set to be funny. You want to create a kind of setting for the jewel of the action. And that's true in a restaurant. If you go to a restaurant and the meal comes and it's cold, it may be that the kitchen is too far away from the table, or there's not a service station. There's sort of basic crafting of the experience that has a lot to do with what is a guest you experience. I had an experience on a project called Lucky Guy for George Wolfe. It was Nora Ephron's last play. And there was a scene, it took place in the late 70s, which was the time I came to New York and the time George came to New York. And it was about a journalist named Mike McAleary. And there was a scene that took place in a restaurant. And I thought, I got this covered. And it was a banquet. And I love banquets. They're the most personal part of the restaurant. They're something you touch, you hug. You know, you think about Hollywood booths, different kinds of booths. So we created this banquet, and we put it on stage in tech rehearsals. And George kept saying, you know, they're having trouble with that banquet. So I said, well, let's make it wider. Let's adjust it. And they still couldn't get the banquet right. And I was thinking, God, if there's one piece of furniture I understand, it's the banquet. And it turned out the truth was it needed to be free of a banquet, because what they were trying to do was not be confined by the walls around it. So we came up with another way to do that same scene. But it was a humbling and interesting moment that says, as a designer, you always need to be aware of what's going to serve the piece, what's going to serve the play, what's going to create the strongest connection.
So you actually answered a question I was going to ask a little bit later, which was how much of the actor experience or what's happening on stage changes your design. But it sounds like it happens more often than not, where you load in and then suddenly it's not working for whatever reason.
Well, that's a complicated question, because so much is predetermined. And, you know, there's so many different ways directors like to work about how much flexibility is built into the dynamic. One of the things we're discovering in Tootsie, for instance, having been out of town in Chicago, is... there are moments, and there's a restaurant in that, the second scene is a restaurant, we're working on how to sequence the transitions so the audience feels each one of those transitions more. So the scenic pieces aren't changing. What's changing is the rhythm based on working with the actors in Michael's apartment, which is a full stage, almost like a Neil Simon comedy inside of a musical. You know, that's changed a great deal based on how the actors are using it and how Scott Ellis is using it. So that will get a lot of reworking.
Is there a typical sequencing when a show is being developed in terms of design? So for me, it would seem like a set, like the set design would have to come first. But is that always the case?
It's usually the case.
Right. And everything else sort of builds off of your design.
So what we'll do is we'll sit with a script and do a scene-by-scene breakdown mm-hmm. and do a lot of research. And research isn't always in the you know, in the case of Tootsie, one of the things that intrigued me and was daunting was the number of musicals that have been set in New York City. So, you know, as opposed to being afraid of that, we sort of dove deep into that history of musical set in New York, and we thought about what would be the kind of unique take of this. And lots of image research, lots of texture research. And I found silhouettes of the city that had a very crisp line, and we started to do watercolors and thought, you know, and in fact, there is a very interesting thing about Michael discovering things about himself and the relationship of Dorothy and Michael, creating a city that is both masculine and feminine. So it led to this sharp watercolor world that, you know, that wouldn't have been a first choice. So we'll do a scene-by-scene breakdown. We'll sit with a director. I remember in the case of Hairspray, we sort of over-delivered. And by the second meeting, we had a room full of way too much design. And Jack O'Brien put his arm around me, and he said, why don't we take everything out of the room that doesn't make you fall in love with Tracy Turnblad? And so understanding what the backstory is critical.
Mm-hmm. On Hairspray, did you start with a light wall, or did that come later?
It came pretty early on, because we started to think about the 60s and the Necco wafers, which is what the White World was based on, and the sort of tie-dyed...
Oh, it's not Light Bright, it's Necco wafers?
No, there are two things. The Nicest Kids in Town, that wall background, was based on Necco wafer colors. The Light Bright wall, we actually had a Light Bright toy. We had lots of toys, and we were playing with that. And it was, I believe, the first show to use LED in that way. So it was almost like big vacuform Tupperware with a small LED light in it. So that came early on. What was interesting is once we had that device is understanding where to unleash that, mm-hmm. which right. was Welcome to the 60s. The same is true in Tootsie. You know, we're following Michael's journey to be a superstar. And at the end of the first act, he unleashes his real ambition about that. And New York becomes this sort of Times Square-like barrage of lights. One of the questions I'm most interested in when I begin a design is, what's the arc? What's the journey the audience is going on, and how do we represent that in the set? When you think about it, directors have such an interesting job because they're trying to get the best out of each one of the creatives they're working with. And I find a director who says, I want this, and shows you what they want, in some ways stops the creative process from ever getting more involved in that. So you know, everyone wants to have a chance to say what they want it to be, but you want to be able to play together.
And when you're designing a show, when do you start showing ideas or designs to the director or to the team? How early? Because you mentioned that you do a lot of research. It sounded like for Hairspray you got an actual Light Bright. It sounded like you got toys and other materials in which to be inspired by.
Well, so in the case of Kiss Me Kate, we met early on because I had two observations I wanted to talk to Scott about. One was, in the research, so much of it is this backstage story, and so many beautiful images of backstage are kind of atmospheric and dark, and Scott knew he wanted to see the opening number. He wanted to be a peek into that backstage world that evolves in front of the audience. But the show within a show, The Chaming of the Shrew, requires a kind of bawdy, energetic thing. And we looked at those two contrasting worlds, And then in addition to that, he said, well, I was intrigued that most productions of Kiss Me, Kate, in some ways treat the show within the show as an archetype. And we said, well, what if the show within a show had a slightly stronger concept? What if it doesn't look like a rental version of The Taming of the Shrew? So that led to, well, what would that concept be, which became a sort of color idea that each one of the four scenes of The Taming of the Shrew in some ways is all based on one color. So it does give it a slightly stronger concept. So we had to get into that early because it affected what Jeff Mashey would do. And we wanted to make sure that that mixture of an invitation to this backstage world and the kind of comedy edge could work together.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at OutsidersMusical.com.
So I realized I didn't answer that. Every time you think you have an answer, like, I can think of projects where I showed the director something early on, and they looked at it and said, well, what's that? We can't do that. And then 4 months later, you come back to that having been through the process, and that turns out to be the right thing. The right answer.
And that's a hard question to answer because every show is different, and obviously it's going to relate to whatever it is you're working on, how quickly you show people whatever, or what that process is.
And in many
like.
Cases, as I said, the research and the ideation starts long before you get to the project.
Right. Which it sounds like for you, on all of your projects, no matter what you're designing, it sounds like that is one of the more labor-intensive parts, is the research, is all that sort of back story, that back work that you do before you start the hammer and nails and, you know, that work.
I'm curious if you could regale us with some of your inspiration and process behind the renovation of the Helen Hayes, which obviously is a huge project that was very exciting for Broadway. Second Stage Theater having purchased the Helen Hayes and completely renovating it through your design. What was your vision for that theater, and how did it come about?
Well, it's an essay question. I am still in awe of the Broadway theater community. Mm. You know, I just think it, the fact that everyone, in architects talk about collaboration as having like an internet site set up where you collaborate online. And in theater, you're in the room together doing your work. And so when we were approached about the Helen Hayes, it was equal parts excitement and terror. Like, I didn't really want to, I wanted to treat it with the respect it deserved. But at the same time, I think that one of the things that's so interesting about theater is it morphs and changes. So we did research into the Helen Hayes. It opened in 1912. It had been renovated many times. It was open as a 299-seat theater with no balcony. And then I think 1912 it opened up. 1917, I believe, the balcony was added. It had been landmarked in the 80s And the landmark designation designated the outside and the inside, the audience chamber, and the lobby for that matter. Carol Rothman, like a good director, like a very proactive good director, once a week we would get together and she would emphasize that she wanted this to be a place for contemporary American drama. When it opened, Winthrop Ames, who was the original builder of it, built it as an antidote to bigger commercial theater. And it felt like this aha moment where her mission and that mission so aligned. So we started by understanding and believing that you could respect the building, but to repaint it, to try and recreate it, what it was in 1912, given that it had no balcony, it had these tapestries that were no longer there. There were so many elements that were different that we started to explore how could you both restore it and give it new life? How could you look forward and look backwards at the same time? And again, as I said, you got to start your interest long before you get to the project. I've always been interested in theaters like the New Amsterdam or many of Joseph Urban's interiors that use color in a very saturated way. So when we looked at the tapestries that had hung there originally, which were reproductions, by the way, done by scenic artists even in 1912, we started to explore the idea of taking one of those tapestries and creating one color that would immerse the audience and do this pixelated kind of contemporary translation of one of the tapestries. And it came out of Carol thought what she wanted was a contemporary object. And I couldn't get my mind around an object and thought maybe the better way to do it was create a contemporary wrapper.
Meaning she wanted the image painted to be contemporary?
No, long before we got to the image, the notion of how we would make it historic and contemporary was let's put a thing in it, a proscenium, a chandelier, and something that represented current day versus historic. And when we came up with the idea of using color, she loved the idea. And then we met with Landmarks. And, you know, Landmarks is there to protect historic interiors, but they agreed that this was a good way to go. And
was that a difficult process to get them to agree, or were they on board right away?
No, they're never on board right away.
Because it's bold what you've done. I mean, it's really it's beautiful, but it's very, very daring. I think it's a real risk. Not a risk, but it's a bold choice. And bold choices sometimes are met with resistance.
Well, we had several strong arguments for that resistance. The first one, it is reversible. So it's paint.
Right.
We restored all the molding. And I believe the monochromatic treatment actually celebrates the molding. It's a little bit like a monochromatic sculpture, more than trying to do some slavish reproduction of what we think the color looked like in 1912.
Right.
So I think we convinced him, A, it was the right thing to do, and B, it was reversible.
Well, you also...
But Landmarks always says no first.
Right. Oh, that's their job, right? To say no to everything, right?
But like producers.
Right.
None that I've worked with, but I've heard some producers
right,
do
right.
that. Producers I work with always say, sure.
Always?
Always.
Well, you're a lucky man. It's interesting
to me.
Or
delusional. Maybe that's just what I hear.
Then only you know that. The thing that I find so remarkable about the interior is not only the pixelation, but how the single color, even though it gradiates, is that the right word term?
Yeah.
It makes an intimate theater much more intimate, which is fascinating because it is a small, intimate space.
There
isn't
the smallest.
There isn't a bad seat in the house,
right.
And yet you've managed to make it feel even cozier.
Well, not to get overly analytic about it, but I've done research in every Broadway theater. And it came out of one of the theater owners wanted to build a new Broadway musical house. So I set aside a year to look at each theater and to see what worked and what didn't work. And what the Helen Hayes does is it gets darker towards the proscenium. So it's lightest at the back, and the color ombre is darkest towards the proscenium. So in some ways, it cedes control of the room to the set designer. And I was working on Lobby Hero. I had this very strange moment where I had to realize my job was to stop looking at the walls, and you know, it was now. And that was a great gift that Carol and Tripp gave me to do the first show there.
Do you think that that dark color towards the proscenium is going to forever influence other set designers on how they design, or does it free them to design whatever they want?
Well, there's been three shows in there so far, each one totally different.
Right.
So I think by ombreing to black, it basically passes the baton to the set designer.
That's fantastic. What I'm fascinated by your year-long research.
Yes, me too.
On
you
Broadway. You take it, Rob, because I can
well,
feel
Well, no, I'm just curious, in the course of that process, what are some other big takeaways that you learned or discovered about what makes a theater successful or not of the 41 Broadway houses that...
Well, successful in visual terms. Because you asked what theaters I'd love to work in. There are theaters where the backstage space is fantastic. The front of house is not magical.
Right.
There are theaters where the theater is beautiful and the lobby is awkward. You know, so they're sort of heroic, these theaters that have stood the test of time. And one of the interesting things was so much of what defines, I think, a great physical theater experience is how that transition from the audience to the stage is handled. Mm. If you look at the Majestic, you look at the Schubert, or you look at the New Amsterdam, that zone of 20 feet or so, whatever it is that takes the audience and sort of shakes hands with the stage, how that transition is handled, because that's what really shapes the space. That's, I think, one of the key things.
Wow.
Let's play a little fantasy football for a second. Let's say we got the Hellinger back.
Yes.
What would you do to it?
Well, I haven't seen it in a while. I looked at photographs of the Hellinger because for Tootsie, we're going to the Marquee, which has lots of backstage space. But in terms of characters, a pretty neutral contemporary space. And we're creating the show that's a love song to New York and the theater community. So we're creating a rather elaborate proscenium. So I went back and looked at the Mark Hellinger. What would I do with it? I would hope that some great director would hire me to do the first show in there.
There you go.
We're working on a project on 30th Street called The Shed. New ground-up cultural institution. We're partnered with Diller Scofidio Renfro. We've been on for 10 years. And one of the things that's embedded in the building is ways that the shift from one show to another can minimize labor and maximize the show. So if you were looking at the Mark Hellinger and it was going to be coming back online, it would be interesting to think about what can you do to the theater that would be most show ready, that the shows can get in and out with as much of the money going into the show and not the theater as possible.
Well, one of the things that I...
Which we did at the Hayes, the light, you know, we tried to work with Josh Dax and lighting positions, everything we could think about to allow that turnover to happen.
Well, you know, one of the things that is, I think, increasingly becoming a source of frustration, probably for producers more than anyone else, but certainly for audience members and me as a critic, is the limitation built into just about every Broadway theater, except for the Circle and the Square, of the proscenium. That they're all pretty much structured the same way.
Yeah.
There's different, you know, sizes, different sight lines. As a designer, is that ever a source of frustration for you? Do you ever yearn to want to break free of that proscenium? Because there are other spaces in New York that don't have it and are doing really exciting large-scale works.
Totally agree. And I think that's a matter of not trying to force a concept that isn't meant to be in a Broadway theater in a Broadway theater. Mm. I was lucky enough to see Hal Prince's Candide, and then really lucky to work with Hal Prince many years later to create the theater for Phantom of the Opera in Las Vegas. And you meet him with Hal Prince in his office. He has the model of Candide, which I believe was Eugene Lee. And it reduced the seating capacity by 800 seats or something in the Broadway. So, you know, it was extraordinary, but you have to have, because when you break the proscenium, come out that far, you have to re-rake the balcony for sight lines, and there's so many constraints that what you're saying is absolutely critical. And I think when there's a concept that isn't meant to live within a Broadway theater, that's forced to live within a Broadway theater, I think sometimes you're not getting the creative result you want, and you're spending a lot of money to torture the theater physically to do things that it's not going to do.
Could Hal Prince's Candide happen today? Could you gut a theater of its seats?
Well, I don't think they gutted it. I think what they did was kill seats by coming out in the audience and eliminating the balcony. Natasha Pierre spent a vast amount of money with an incredible reworking of that theater. The budget had to include restoring it, though. So, you know, it's a daunting challenge.
It sounds very cost preventative to do anything like that.
You know, look, in the fantasy football scenario, there are thoughts I've had that I've spoken to theater owners about ways to work within the theater. One of the things I'm interested in architecture and in theater is less hardware and more software. So certainly can't qualify the Shed as not a lot of hardware because it's a big new building, but it's going to be remembered for the software. It's being designed to allow productions to be the thing you remember. And I think there are ways to create productions in Broadway theaters that, in a way, sort of linking to what Hal Prince did for Candide, where you're reducing capacity, but you're also not creating a big, expensive physical installation.
Before we let you go, I know you have to venture on to somewhere else after this. We always ask everybody, what was that first show that did it for them? It can be a community theater, it can be Broadway. What bit you?
What a great question. Well, Sheldon Harnick got an award last week that he asked me to give to him. I was about the fourth speaker, and every speaker before me said their first show was Fiddler on the Roof. And I thought, Jesus, there's my... Because that was the first Broadway show I saw. But you asked it in a different way. You said, what's the first show that impacted me? And it was when we did The King and I in Deal, New Jersey. And there were a couple things that I remember about it. One is there's photographs of the set, which are so not what I remember. I remember it rivaled Joe Melsiner.
Of course.
And I helped paint them. And I guess I was 12. I was in it as one of the kids in the March of the Siamese Kids. And I remember that incredible experience of my memory of it. And then I went back with my daughter not too long ago to look at the school in Deal, New Jersey, which was so dinky. And so it made me think about, how in some cases our experience and memories and the things that drive us aren't dependent necessarily on all the bells and whistles. When I saw Fiddler, which was my first Broadway show, the thing that I was bit with is how, and then I became a fan and a student of Boris Aronson and started to collect his work, is how in theater, moments are created when all these elements work together. If you just took the design or the music or the movement or the story, it doesn't really work unless they're all unified. And then recently seeing Joel Grey's incredible production in Yiddish without Boris's set, without all of that, that circular movement, without the turntable, still linked to that experience.
Yes, that's an. It's funny. We talk about Fiddler a lot on this
podcast.
On this podcast. It really is, I think, that show for a lot of people.
It's such a touchstone. Yeah,
it really is. And Joel's production is magnificent.
You know, one of the greatest gifts in my life in theater was making the set presentation of She Loves Me to Sheldon Harnick, who is now 95, I think. But we become dear friends, and you just saw that look of incredible intelligent curiosity. And then as we were teching the show, he was there every day with his wife Margie in the second row, just marveling at it. And it was like an amazing full circle.
That's high praise.
Right.
That's quite a compliment.
If I could sneak in one last question.
Sure.
And you might have answered it by bringing up She Loves Me. But is there a show that you dream of putting your stamp on or your design to?
Well, I had Dreams of the King and I, but that didn't work out. You know, it's so much of what I find about working in the theater is surprise. She Loves Me, I had never seen before, and I remember Scott Ellis telling me, you've got to do this, David, it's the perfect show. And as I started to delve into it, so no, there's no one thing I'm dying to do. There was one thing I was dying to do that I did do, which is work in Central Park at the Delacorte, because I had been going there ever since I came to New York, and that was a totally divine experience on every level.
Yeah.
The level of help and stagehands and then being there in front of that audience. So I'm sort of open to new experiences and want to maintain that little bit of terror when you got a new project,
right,
of making, you know, not knowing the answer. I think that's critical.
That's the theater, right?
That's the theater.
Aren't they redoing the Delacorte? I just read.
They are.
They are redoing the Delacorte. So well, now I have to want to work in it again.
I was going
to
say, well, you can get the inaugural production when they reopen.
And you know, the first production I worked on there was the Julius Caesar, which was very controversial.
Oh, yes,
yes,
I saw it.
Well, controversy is not such a bad thing.
Controversy is not a bad thing.
Well, thank you very much for coming down and chatting with us. It was
a treat.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I like your little Orso setup here.
Yeah, it's a good little niche, a good little spot.
It gets louder as we go on,
And do we hear the sound of Orso in the background?
You will. Yeah.
That's pretty great.
Yeah, you will.
Some atmosphere. As David Rockwell mentioned, and we talked about briefly, one of his many exciting new projects is The Shed. So you may be wondering, okay, I got a sort of a sense of what this is, but I'm not entirely clear. Well, you're not alone. First off, you may remember that the rail yards near New York Penn Station were rezoned as part of the city's 2012 bid to host the Summer Olympics. Well, that didn't really work out. But officials then solicited plans, as David mentioned, for a mixed-use development of offices, apartments, and retail that became known as Hudson Yard. One major condition put upon the developers of Hudson Yard by the City of New York, though, was that this sprawling new development complex includes space for a nonprofit cultural center. And thus, The Shed was born. The Shed, as David mentioned, will be New York's first multi-art center purposefully designed to commission, produce, and present all types of performing arts, visual arts, and popular culture. Driven by experimentation, innovation, and collaboration, The Shed will be a center for artistic invention, bringing together leading artists working in every art form with leading minds in the humanities and the sciences. If all that sounds still a little ambiguous, if not majorly ambitious, that's kind of the point. Alex Poots, The Shed's artistic director and the founding chief executive, recently told the New York Times, quote, "The Shed is interested in the advancement of art forms, whereas other institutions are about preserving the treasures of the past," end quote. Its commissioning model will be to provide the space, support, and resources for practitioners to experiment with, produce, and present original work, offering new experiences to the widest and most diverse audiences possible. The Shed is not a rigid, purpose-built theater or concert hall or exhibition space. It is meant to be all of these things at once. And that's exactly where David Rockwell comes in. Nestled on a city-owned plot of land amid a cluster of soaring skyscrapers on the south side of Hudson Yards development site, The Shed's physical space, designed by David's firm, in collaboration with Diller, Scafidio, and Renfro, this building will be a six-story, 200,000-square-foot structure that will house two expansive, column-free galleries totaling 25,000 feet of museum-quality space, a 500-seat black-box theater that can be subdivided into even more intimate spaces, event and rehearsal space, and a creative lab that will be provided free of charge for early career local artists. The Shed's most notable design feature, though, the thing that gives it its name, is its rolling outer shell that deploys over the plaza adjoining the building to create a 120-foot-high, temperature-controlled hall, or shed. When the shell is nested over the fixed building, the 17,000-square-foot plaza next door will be open, outdoor, public space that can be used for outside programming. And yet, when it expands, it'll become this soaring hall that can be used for just about anything. In a nod toward demonstrating what will make the Shed different from other cultural institutions in the city, a recent open call for artists specifically focused on young practitioners based in New York rather than Europe, and made clear that the Shed was open to and interested in all art forms, performing, visual, literary, comedy, fashion, design, science, and new media work. In fact, New York Fashion Week is already publicly considering moving all of its programming to the Shed. For its first season, seven commissions have just been announced. Well, actually, I think eight, because David mentioned that there was an eighth announced today, including a play by classicist writer Ann Carson and a collaboration between painter Gerhard Richter and the composer Steve Reich and Arvo Part. A live celebration of African music will be produced by Quincy Jones and British filmmaker Steve McQueen. The Shed has a hard opening date of spring 2019. Its building and the first 3 years of programming are set to cost about $550 million, over $460 million of which has already been raised, including a $50 million grant from the City of New York and a $75 million personal donation from former New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg, who made the Shed and Hudson Yard more broadly a personal priority of his administration. The Shed's vision is one of parity across all forms of art, creativity, and intellectual inquiry, and it will be housed in a building equally as visionary, thanks to David Rockwell and his collaborators. I, for one, can't wait to check it out.
Jamie here. That's our show. Thanks for listening. I'd like to say a very special thank you to Orso Restaurant for hosting us tonight and for being so hospitable and their delicious food, as always. The Fabulous Invalid is a production of O&M Etc. and The Fabulous Invalid LLC. Our theme music is by Lucky Chops. Find us on iTunes and tune in next Wednesday.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but yeah. Not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.